Chapter 18. Stock up on snow globes. The zombie apocalypse is coming. If you would like to quickly round up a whole lot of assholes all in one spot, I suggest going to the airport. In a normal environment, I'd say that about 5% of any nearby population are assholes. FYI, another 2% are total bastards and 10% are fine, but they think that they're better than you. 10% are awesome unless you push them too hard and then they get sort of stabby. And probably 0.0001% are serial killers or people who intentionally make pants too small. And about 32% are awesome but secretly suspect that there's something very wrong with them, which there is, and that's why they're so awesome. And 6% are questioning the validity of this breakdown right now and want to see the raw data, but I'm not going to give it to them because this is not a book about statistics. And besides, 37% of all statistics are made up on the spot, so I'm not even sure what you're expecting from me. As I was saying before I was rudely interrupted by math, in a normal environment, about 5% of the population are assholes. Go to an average airport and suddenly the asshole population leaps exponentially. You might disagree and point out that you never see any assholes at your airport, and that's usually a pretty good indication that you might be one of them. Sorry. I don't really blame you, though, as it seems to be out of your hands. And believe me, I can relate. Whenever I have to do story problems, I turn into a small, burrowing animal, and I often find myself hiding in a cupboard, so I'm not judging you. Except that I sort of am, because my hiding from math in cupboards hurts no one, except possibly the cupboards, whereas people being assholes on planes makes me want to poke them with large sticks. It is such a strange phenomenon. People who, outside of airports, might normally hold open doors or stop cars for crossing ducklings will suddenly be fine with plowing down elderly women and kicking small children out of the way in order to get to their pre-assigned, horrifically cramped seats. They'll stand in crowds, circling the boarding lane and blocking other passengers who have earlier boarding tickets than them, and will glare at anyone who tries to walk around them. A few hours later, you will see these exact same people breathing heavily and glancing around with trapped animal eyes, straining against their seatbelt the moment the plane begins to descend, and they will immediately leap up as soon as the seatbelt sign goes off in order to be the first person to aggressively stand in a line of people who are not going anywhere for quite some time. I always wonder about these people. I can only suspect that they must have some sort of weird standing in line fetish. It's my personal opinion that airlines can do two things in order to make airline travel better for everyone. The first is to have the people taking boarding tickets recognize the person who seems the most unreasonably determined to be sitting on the plane, hold up their arm, and joyfully announce over the loudspeaker, "You, sir, you are our winner for most unaccountably and frantically eager to get on a plane that will not leave until every single person is seated anyway. Well done, you. Can you tell us how you feel now that you've won?" At best, he will realize he's being a bit douchey, laugh it off, and might calm the hell down from now on. At worst, he will start yelling, and then everyone else gets a good show. And then give him a small medal and a mild tranquilizer, plus a mild tranquilizer for the person who has to sit next to him. And if you're handing him out, I'll take one too. In fact, mild tranquilizers for everyone. I apologize for that gender stereotyping, but in fairness, it usually is a he. And he's usually in a business suit. And he often has triple diamond status. And he's occasionally my husband. Frankly, if we all had tranquilizers, that would reduce the need for the second part of my plan to make air travel less awful. There's always that one person who is making a nuisance of themselves because they're furious that their enormous bags don't fit, they're loudly muttering racist bullshit about people who aren't actually terrorists, or they've had too many tranquilizers and now they can't swallow correctly. I've been there on that last one, but in my defense, I'd mixed up my anti-anxiety sedatives with my heartburn medication, and so I'd like to think it was less that I was drooly and more that I was just slightly too generous with my saliva. Regardless, I think it would serve everyone as a community if the flight attendants were able to whack one person per flight in the head with a pinata stick for being the stupidest damn person on the plane. It wouldn't hurt them permanently, but if it happened to them more than once, they're probably going to get the picture because how else are they going to learn? This would be helpful because I think we're all a bit stressed and judgmental on planes, and probably at one time or another, each of us would get hit with a pinata stupid stick, and it would be a good reminder to be more compassionate to others. Personally, I'm most likely to get whacked in the head because my anxiety disorder gets really bad on planes, and so I end up panicking a bit. Usually, I get on Twitter and I tell everyone that I love them because it's about that time that my anti-anxiety pills kick in and they make me super sentimental and scared that I'm going to die. It's like taking ecstasy, but instead of having sex and going to a rave, I just want someone to stroke my hair and sing me old Irish drinking songs. Unfortunately, I always end up sitting next to people who don't know any drinking songs at all and spend their time making pie charts, which is pretty much the worst use of pie ever. During my last book tour, I flew constantly, and it really fucked with my anxiety disorder to the point where I eventually had a mild nervous breakdown, which they now refer to as vital exhaustion for some reason. My shrink suggested that if I was going to continue traveling so much, I should look into getting a service animal expressly trained to provide emotional support to people with anxiety disorders. I considered getting Hunter S. Tomcat trained, but then I remembered that he gets spontaneous nervous diarrhea every time he's in a moving car. And I would imagine that holding a cat who seems to have explosive plane dysentery wouldn't necessarily help my anxiety so much as it would just give me something new and horribly unsanitary to be anxious about. So I called around two different service animal specialists. And I spoke to a woman who told me that it's better to get an animal who has already been trained and has the right temperament. She also told me that cats aren't preferred emotional support animals for anxiety disorder, but my cats hate dogs, so I figured I was fucked. But then she told me that the Americans with Disabilities Act was recently interpreted as allowing people with anxiety disorders to travel with an emotional support pony on airlines. So basically, I could bring a goddamn pony on board with me. I'm pretty sure a pony wouldn't fit under my seat or in my lap, but I rather like the idea of a small medicinal horse standing in the aisle beside me while I braided his mane. Plus, Pony Danza would make a great pack animal, and instead of bringing suitcases, I could just put all my extra clothes on him, and that way I wouldn't have to pay to check a bag. Plus, the pony wouldn't get cold because it would be wearing my pajamas. I tried to convince Victor that this was a win-win situation, but he got all shitty about us having an indoor pony pet, even though I pointed out that it was for my mental illness. He responded that he had no doubt that my mental illness was involved in a decision that would eventually conclude with a bunch of horses in bed with us, and I reiterated that I only needed one medicinal pony, but he argued that I would eventually claim that the pony was lonely, and then one day he'd come home to a house full of ponies. I didn't respond because we both knew he was right. Besides, I'm pretty sure the girl who brings her horse on the plane is going to get hit with a pinata stupid stick every flight, and Victor's probably just trying to save me from myself and from a concussion. Truthfully, though, ponies on planes are small change compared to some of the things I've seen. Like the time the lady sitting next to me listened to every single ringtone available on the highest volume possible in the 30 minutes that we waited for everyone else to board. Or one time, Victor was sitting in the quiet, wooden cubicle section of the President's Club where the professional people go to work on their laptops during layovers. There was this older man in Victor's row who had his headphones plugged into his laptop so he could watch True Blood, and out of nowhere, he lunged toward the screen and screamed, "Look out, Sookie!" so loud that Victor accidentally screamed a little too. Or the guy who was sitting two rows ahead of me one time, who was super careful to hold his phone in such a way that no one around him would notice that he was watching hardcore porn on the plane. And probably no one would have noticed if he'd remembered to plug the earphones he was wearing into the phone jack, but he didn't. And so he groaned in frustration, I hope, and kept turning the volume up louder and louder until he realized the problem. Or the woman in front of me in the security line who asked if they would put her cat, Dave, through the luggage x-ray machine because she wanted to see if he'd eaten her necklace. What the fuck, Dave? Get it together. I have to admit, though, that occasionally I'm the one causing the scene. Like this one time, I bought an antique basket in California, but it wouldn't fit in my suitcase, so I decided to carry it on like a purse. Except that it was a basket made out of a dead armadillo, and the handle was its tail, and it didn't fit under the seat, so I tried to hide it in my lap. But the flight attendant was like, "Ma'am, you need to place your armadillo in the overhead compartment." And I said, "I can just hold him. He's carry-on and carry-on." But she made me stuff him under the seat, but he wouldn't fit. And I ended up sighing to my seatmate that I just chipped two nails on my armadillo, and this is exactly why people hate to fly. I considered keeping a nail file in my armadillo for the future, tucking the file under one of his armored plates so that it would fold down when you didn't need it. And it sounded like such a good idea that I thought you could probably add a cheese knife and a corkscrew and make a Swiss Army armadillo. A Swiss Army dillo. I made a note on my phone to create a Swiss Army dillo, but spell check changed it to create a Swiss Army dildo, which frankly just seems painful and excessive. Victor believes that people turning into assholes is a new phenomenon because flying 20 years ago was much easier and less stressful. I have to take his word on that because my family always drove or camped on vacations. This included a summer trip to Lost Maples at age 9 when we returned to my grandparents' camper after a morning of fishing to discover that a band of squirrels had chewed a hole through the cloth of the pop-up camper and shit everywhere. It was like a shit sprinkler had gone off in there, and we were horrified, but also grudgingly impressed. Perhaps the neighborhood squirrels were mad because they could see campers relieving themselves in the woods, and they were like, "Really, asshole? You just shit in my living room. Now this is happening in your living room. I can do this all day, motherfucker." Hard to say. Squirrels can be real conundrums. Still, angry, shitty squirrels can't hold a candle to angry, shitty people in airports, and if you have ever doubted this, you have probably never seen a person refuse to switch seats so that a parent can sit with their small child who was inexplicably assigned a seat on the opposite side of the plane. Once in Chicago, I saw a man refuse to switch seats with a mother who had bought a seat for her 10-month-old but hadn't been given a seat next to the baby. She asked the man who was assigned the seat beside her if he could sit on the same window seat a few rows up, and he refused. "I'm sitting in the seat assigned to me because those are the rules. This is my seat," he grumped as he sat down huffily. What I really wanted was for that mother to stand up and say, "You know what? Fine. This is the baby seat anyway. I'm two rows behind you guys. Have a good flight, baby. Hope you like screaming and urine, sir." Of course, the surrounding passengers quickly gave up their seats to switch around before it ever came to that, which is sort of a shame because I think it would have been a just punishment. Sitting next to a crying, kicking baby on an airplane is not fun and is almost as hellish as being the parent of a crying, kicking baby on an airplane, which is practically as terrible as being the crying, kicking baby on an airplane. Last year, CNN brought me on live TV to discuss a proposal to create kid-free planes, and I explained that if we were really going to start segregating passengers, I'd prefer to ride in an a-hole free plane because babies almost never ask you to join the Mile High Club or clip their toenails while in flight or do any of a plethora of horrible things that I've witnessed from others. The CNN anchor seemed slightly aghast that I had said a-hole and Mile High Club live on air, but they really should have expected it because several months earlier, they asked me about mommies and politics, and I explained on air that I don't usually write about either subject, but that I thought it was a little condescending for anyone to call me mommy unless they had personally come out of my lady garden. And I also explained that I would like political candidates to present their prep plans for the zombie apocalypse or for the robot revolution or for when the internet becomes self-aware, because at least then the debates would be more interesting. Surprisingly, CNN has not asked me on again, although I would like to note that I asked the woman on the pre-call if I could say vagina on TV, and she said she thought I'd better not. So I said, "Well, can I say my lady garden?" English was not her first language, so she needed some help on that, yelling, "Is my lady garden okay?" to the people near her, and she said that no one seemed to have a problem with it. Of course, it's possible that no one had a problem with it because there wasn't any context, so no one knew it was a euphemism, or maybe everyone in the office assumed that the woman was fishing for compliments about her lady garden. Regardless, I think it all worked out for CNN because that clip ended up being the most popular video of the day, and it was nice to be able to call my parents and proudly tell them, my lady garden is going viral. In hindsight, that might have been a poor choice of phrasing. Victor travels at least weekly for business and thinks that increased security at airports is the thing that's making people insane because they seem to lose all sense of logic in the security line. One time, Victor witnessed a guy carrying a gallon of homemade iced tea in his carry-on. The TSA agent pulled out the leaking jug and looked at it like it was a severed arm and then said, "Sir, I just asked you if you had any liquids." And then the man testily replied, "I don't. That's iced tea." And the agent paused for a second and sighed and explained that iced tea is a liquid, to which the passenger condescendingly replied, "No, dumbass, it's a beverage." And then the TSA agent hit him with a piñata stick, or that's how it would have worked out, at least in my world. Everyone gets caught accidentally sneaking weird stuff through security sometimes, though. Our friend Jason travels with us a lot and is forever bringing inappropriate things through airports. Last month, Victor and Jason went to a conference in Vegas, and Jason tried to bring through an industrial-sized jar of hair gel from Costco. It was like something from a barber college, Victor told me later, and security was like, "Sir, you're like 72 ounces over the limit." Jason just shrugged, scooped out a big handful, and put it on his hair for later. It was like the size of a Crisco can. You could have put both hands in there. I tried to convince Victor that Jason was probably doing this on purpose to fuck with him. Nope. He did the same thing in China last year, he said. He told me he bought a bottle of wine, but they wouldn't let him bring it on, so he angrily drank it in security so that it wouldn't be wasted. Well, I said, that showed them. Yeah, it showed him what a drunk American looks like trying to put his shoes back on. And he did the same thing when we were in Mexico last year. Remember when he brought 2 liters of hot sauce at the airport? Oh, that was awesome, I said, nodding. But I'm pretty sure we were all too drunk to remember that we hadn't gone through security yet. Besides, isn't hot sauce a beverage? Victor glared at me, but I bet he was laughing on the inside. But in a bring this whole thing full circle sort of way, I'm starting to suspect that maybe the reason why people are jerks at airports is because of the zombie apocalypse. Let me explain. Have you ever noticed that all of the stuff on the posters of what you can't bring to the airport terminal is pretty much exactly the same stuff that would come in really handy if a zombie apocalypse broke out? Swords, guns, grenades, meat cleavers, fire, disinfectant, booze, chainsaws. These are all things I would want on me if there was a zombie epidemic in Terminal B. Basically, if we get attacked inside the airport, we're all fucked. So maybe people are just scared because they've been disarmed. Even the phrasing of where you're headed, the terminal, is another word for approaching immediate death. But on the plus side, airport security probably has a giant stash of brass knuckles and grenades and chainsaws that they've confiscated from people, so we could probably still arm ourselves if necessary. Side note, can you even buy brass knuckles anymore? I'd be pissed if I had to give up my brass knuckles at the airport. Those things are pricey. I often take photos of the posters showing the prohibited items that you can't take through security to use as an outline for preparing my own zombie prep kit, and it's interesting how they subtly change from airport to airport. Some of them can be quite intimidating and are filled with items that you wouldn't think you'd have to put on a sign, like machine guns and dynamite. Others focus more on having too much lotion. At our airport, it says you can't bring in snow globes. Swear to God, snow globes. Which seems weird. It's not like you're going to be attacked by a zombie and think, Jesus, if only I had my snow globe. Victor recently looked over my ever-growing list entitled Things Not Allowed Through Security That Would Be Good to Have During the Zombie Apocalypse, and he thought it was questionable. Why do you have booze on your list? He asked. You think I'm going to go into the zombie apocalypse sober? I shook my head. I don't think so. Plus, alcohol is a good disinfectant. Yeah, I'm pretty sure butterscotch schnapps is not ideal for wounds. He knew me too well. And what's this other stuff? Water guns? Lacrosse sticks? This is just a list of things you want to play with. No, I explained, glaring in a way that said that Victor was stupid. They're weapons that don't need ammunition. You can use the lacrosse stick to keep the zombies at a distance, and then you squirt them with acid. Acid, which would melt the water gun, Victor replied. I said, Right. Okay, fine. Then we fill it with holy water in case of vampires. Vampires? I sighed at his ignorance. Well, I think if zombies turn out to be real, then all bets are off, Victor. In fact, I think we might need to start a whole new list labeled in case of vampires, because I'm a planner. Victor laughed and said I was getting a little defensive, but I'm pretty sure defensive is probably a pretty good state of mind to be in when focused on prepping for monster attacks. Assholish and defensive. And unconcerned about babies who will totally slow you down. And with a bunch of pinata sticks that you've sharpened into stakes just in case of vampires. That's how you survive. So I guess maybe the airport isn't always the worst place to be after all. Appendix, an interview with the author. What I want you to know. Dying is easy. Comedy is hard. Clinical depression is no fucking picnic. When my last book came out, I spent a lot of time avoiding people who wanted to interview me because I was afraid that I'd say something wrong or because I couldn't find pants. I decided that this time around, I would just include an entire section with questions and answers, which you can use if you have a story due or need a quote. This seems like an odd use of a chapter, but it's nice because there are always things that you don't get around to writing about and apologies that need to be made, and all of that stuff fits in here. And I realize it's weird that this appendix is in the middle of the book instead of at the end where appendixes are supposed to be, but it works better here, and technically, your appendix is in the middle of your body, so it sort of makes sense. Probably God had the same issue when Adam was like, I don't want to sound ungrateful, but it sort of hurts when I walk. Is that normal? Is this thing on my foot a tumor? And God was like, it's not a tumor. That's your appendix. Appendixes go at the end. Read a book, dude. And Adam was like, really? Because I don't want to second guess you, but this seems like a design flaw. And also that snake in the garden told me it doesn't even do anything. And God shook his head and muttered, Jesus, that fucking snake is like TMZ. And then Adam was like, who's Jesus? And God said, no one yet. It's just this idea I'm throwing around. And then God zapped Adam's appendix off his foot and stuck it in Adam's midsection instead, just in case he decided to use it for something else later. But then the next day, Adam probably asked for a girlfriend and God was like, it's going to cost you a rib. And Adam was like, don't I need those? Can't you just make her out of my appendix? And the snake popped out and hissed, seriously, why are you so attached to this appendix idea? Don't those things occasionally explode for no reason whatsoever? And God was like, this is none of your business, Jefferson. I'm starting to question why I even made you. And Adam was like, wait, what? They explode? And God was like, I'm not negotiating with you, Adam. And that's why appendixes go in the middle and should probably be removed. I have asked Victor to play the role of interviewer because no one else is here but the cats, who are crap at sticking to the subject. Victor is the one asking the questions who is not entirely happy about being dragged into this. I'm the one answering the questions who isn't wearing pants. Okay, what am I even doing here? You, Victor, are pretending to be a reporter for prestigious publications. I need you to ask me interview questions so that other people can steal these quotes when I'm too weird to talk to them. Okay, I have no idea what you want from me. Well, luckily, I'm here to help. Start with a compliment. Something about my hair, maybe. Okay, is that your real hair? Some of it, but it's rude to ask that. Oh, sorry. It's fine, Victor. I forgive you. Just remember this act of kindness when you review my book. And also remember the word revolutionary and the phrase buy a dozen copies for everyone you know. Why would I review your book? I'm your husband. Yes, but you're supposed to be a reporter. My God, you are terrible at role playing. Okay, fine. It seems like by this point in a book about depression, you would have explained what depression is. Well, it's hard to define. Well, this is a book, so maybe try. Okay, fine. Depression is like, it's like when you meticulously scroll up through hundreds of pages in a Word document to find a specific paragraph you need to fix. And then you try to type, but it automatically takes you right down to the bottom because you forgot to place your cursor where you wanted to type. And then you bang your head against the desk because you totally just lost your place. And then your boss walks in while you have your head planted on your desk and you see her shoes behind you and you immediately say, I'm not sleeping. I was just banging my head against the desk because I fucked something up. Huh. Wait. Hang on, no, that's not it. Depression is like When you don't have any scissors to cut that thick plastic safety tie off the new scissors that you just bought because you couldn't find your scissors, and then you just say, fuck it, and you try everything else in the world to get the scissors to open, but all you have are plastic butter knives and they aren't doing anything, so you stand in the kitchen holding scissors that you can't use because you can't find scissors, and then you get frustrated and you throw the scissors in the garbage disposal and you sleep on the couch for a week. And that is what depression is like. So, okay, no, not that. Hang on. Depression is like when you don't want cheese anymore, even though it's cheese. Yeah, Jenny, I want to be helpful, but I don't know if that means that I should ask you to elaborate or tell you to stop elaborating. Okay, let me rephrase. Sometimes being crazy is a demon, and sometimes that demon is me, and I visit quiet sidewalks and loud parties and dark movies, and a small demon looks out at the world with me. And sometimes it sleeps, sometimes it plays, sometimes it laughs with me, sometimes it tries to kill me, but it's always with me. I suppose we're all possessed in some way, some of us with dependence on pills or wine, others through sex or gambling. Some of us through self-destruction or anger or fear, and some of us just carry around our tiny demon as he wreaks havoc on our mind and tears open old, dusty trunks of bad memories, leaves remnants spread everywhere, wearing the skins of people we've hurt, wearing the skins of people we've loved, and sometimes when it's worst, wearing our skins. Those times are the hardest. When you can see yourself confined to your bed because you have no strength or will to leave. And then you find yourself yelling at someone you love because they want to help, but they can't. When you wake up in a gutter after trying to drink or smoke or dance away the ache or the lack thereof. Those times when you are more demon than you are you. I don't always believe in God, but I believe in demons. My psychiatrist always says, but if you believe there are demons, then it follows that there could be a god. It's like believing in dwarves, but not in cyclopses. I considered pointing out that I have met several dwarves in my life and almost no cyclopses, but I get what she's saying. There can't be dark without light. There can't be a devil without the god who created him. There can't be good without bad. And there can't be me without my demon. I think I'm okay with that. Or maybe it's my demon that is. It's hard to tell. My psychiatrist told me that when things get really rough, I should consider my battle with mental illness as if I was exercising a demon. And I was like, well, no wonder I'm failing so miserably. I'm shit at exercising. And then she called me out for deflecting with humor and explained, you are exercising a demon. It's not something you can do alone. Some people do it with a priest in holy water. Some do it with faith. Some do it with chemicals and therapy. And no matter what, it's hard. And usually people end up with vomit on them, I replied. I'm starting to see more of a connection now that I think about it. I wonder if I'm the priest in this scenario. I hope not, because he almost always dies just when you think everything is fine. This analogy is starting to creep me out. Yeah. Jenny, did you just break into an essay in the middle of our interview? I did, sorry. But you're the interviewer, so technically it's your fault for not reining me in. Sure, blame the victim. Okay, I don't have depression, but I've seen you struggle with it. What advice do you have for people who are currently looking for help? Every mental illness is different because every person is different. There aren't any easy cures, but there are so many tools available now that people are finally starting to talk about it. You have to figure out how to survive depression, which is really not easy because when you're depressed, you're more exhausted than you have ever been in your life, and your brain is lying to you, and you feel unworthy of the time and energy, which you often don't even have, needed to get help. That's why you have to rely on friends and family and strangers to help you when you can't help yourself. Lots of people think that they're a failure if their first or second or eighth cure for depression or anxiety doesn't work the way that they wanted, but an illness is an illness. It's not your fault if the medication or therapy that you're given to treat your mental illness doesn't work perfectly, or if it worked for a little while but then stopped working. You aren't a math problem. You're a person. What works for you won't always work for me, and vice versa. But I do believe that there's a treatment out there for everyone if you give yourself the time and patience to find it. Additionally, psychiatrists are always changing shit, so even they don't know exactly what's going on. A mental disorder might be reclassified into a phobia might be reclassified as a disorder. In fact, I asked my shrink to read this book and fix everything that's now outdated, but it'll just be outdated again next week when the Big Book of Crazy is updated again. She agreed that it's hard to keep up with it all, but pointed out that it's actually called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. In my defense, I'm bored with that name, and I think that they would sell more copies of it if they used my title, or maybe Game of Thrones Part 14. Here's what I find helpful. Sunlight, antidepressants, anti-anxiety drugs, vitamin B shots, walking, letting myself be depressed when I need to be, drinking water, watching Doctor Who, reading, telling my husband when I need someone to watch me, making a mixtape of songs that make me feel better, and not allowing myself to listen to the stuff that I want to listen to but I know will make me worse. I talk to people on Twitter when I'm afraid to be out in the world. When I can't be an active mom, I snuggle with my daughter and watch TV with her or ask her to read to me. I replace the moments when I feel like I should be at a PTA meeting with a memory that I hope she'll treasure of us hiding under a blanket fort with the cats. I remind myself that depression lies and that I can't trust my own critical judgment when I'm sick. And if things get really bad, I call the suicide hotline. I'm not suicidal, but I've called several times before to be talked down from hurting myself. They help. They listen. They've been there before. They give advice. They tell you that you aren't crazy. Or sometimes they tell you that you are crazy, but in a good way, a way that makes you special. Okay, so what doesn't help when you're depressed? Everyone's different, so the best thing that you can do is ask the person that you're dealing with what they need. Like, some people prescribe God for depression or self-harm, and I think that can be really helpful for people who aren't me. Some claim that depression can be prayed away or is caused when you don't have enough God in your life. I tried God once, but it didn't work well, so I cut the dose by a third and I just had go. Go where? I asked. No one answered, probably because I didn't have enough God in my life. Someone else told me that capitulating to my depression made me seem ungrateful because Jesus died so that I wouldn't have to suffer, but frankly, Jesus seemed to have more than his fair share of bullshit in his life, too. That guy got nailed to death. I bet people were walking past Jesus and they were like, wow, that guy should have more God in his life. Or maybe they just sent him those horrible emails that say, let go and let God, or God listens to knee mail. Probably not, though, because I don't think email was very popular yet. But I think that's probably for the best because there is nothing more annoying than having someone tell you that everything would be fine if you were just a better prayer, or if you smiled more, or if you stopped drinking Diet Coke. I can tell you that just cheer up is almost universally looked at as the most unhelpful depression cure ever. It's pretty much the equivalent of telling someone who just had their legs amputated to just walk it off. Some people don't understand that for a lot of us, mental illness is a severe chemical imbalance rather than just having a case of the Mondays. Those same well-meaning people will tell me that I'm keeping myself from recovering because I really just need to cheer up and smile. And that's when I consider chopping their arms off and then blaming them for not picking up their severed arms so they can take them to the hospital to get reattached. Just pick them up and take them to get fixed. It's not that hard, Sarah. I pick up stuff all the time. We all do. No, I'm not going to help you because you need to learn how to do this for yourself. I won't always be around to help you, you know. I'm sure you could do it if you just tried. Honestly, it's like you don't even want to have arms. Granted, it's not a perfect analogy because you don't usually lose your arms due to involuntary chemical imbalances, except that if I cut off your arms because of my mental illness, then technically a chemical imbalance did lead to your arms falling off. So it's dangerous for everyone. I guess my point here is that we all suffer when mental illness is not taken seriously. Okay, how do you deal with people who don't understand depression? Some people say, how can you feel bad for yourself when people are starving in Greenland? And I'm like, I don't know, talent? And you can't win because you're given the same guilt when you feel good. How can you laugh when people are starving in Greenland? And again, I don't know. I don't ask starving people in Greenland how they can laugh when people in Sweden are cancerous and missing hands. I don't know if that's right about Sweden or Greenland. I don't keep up with geography. But my point is, sometimes shitty things happen and sometimes they don't. And my rule is, Enjoy the non-shitty things now because shitty things are coming and vice versa. This is just basic life 101. Your family member is sick, your dog needs to go out, you find a lump, people tell you to stop eating gluten. That stuff never stops. So go with the flow and don't apologize for starving people. Unless you are the one starving people, then you should totally apologize. Right. Apologize if you're starving someone. This is all good stuff, Jenny. Right? Oh, I need you to ask me the question on this card because I'm pretty sure it'll be pertinent. Okay. This seems fairly unethical, but whatever. A lot of people have been critical about this book because of fill in the blank with whatever people are currently mad at me about. What is your response? That is an excellent question. Well, you wrote it. Fair enough. But back to the question. First of all, I apologize for that thing that I did. It was incredibly stupid, and I was young and probably drugged. This seems a bit inauthentic since I don't know precisely what you're referring to, but I can assure you that there is at least one thing in this book I will think is ridiculously awful within a few years. This is a real issue that I struggle with. It's tempting to start each sentence with an apology or a disclaimer, to preface everything with, in my life I've found, so that people can't yell at me for being wrong, I often am, or misinformed, sure, or overly emotional, how dare you. But this book is about my life, so I have to simply hope that that unsaid disclaimer is just implied. This is my life and my observations of it, and they change as I change. That's one of the frightening things about writing a book that no one ever tells you. You have to pin down your thoughts and opinions, and they exist on a page ungrowing forever. You may convince yourself that you were never stupid or coarse or ignorant, but one day you reread your seventh grade diary and rediscover the person who one day becomes you, and you vacillate between wanting to hug this unfinished, confused stranger and wanting to shake some damn sense into her. In fact, if you read this book and hated something I wrote, chances are I probably hate it too. Like my grandmother always said, your opinions are valid and important. Unless it's some stupid bullshit you're being shitty about, in which case you can go fuck yourself. Yeah, I'm pretty sure neither of your grandmothers ever said that. Well, I'm paraphrasing, but still. Someone once said that if you make something no one hates, no one will ever love it either, and that's true. The same goes for art and writing and people, especially people. In fact, most of my favorite people are dangerously fucked up, but you'd never guess it, because we've either become adept at hiding it, or we've learned to bear it so honestly that it becomes the new normal. There's this quote from The Breakfast Club that goes, "We're all pretty bizarre. Some of us are just better at hiding it." I have it on a poster, but I took a Sharpie to it and I scratched out the word hiding because it reminds me that there's a certain pride and freedom that comes from wearing your unique bizarreness like a badge of honor. None of us are immune to feelings of failure. Brené Brown has been my friend for more years than I can count, and she's violently successful. She's a PhD, she hangs out with Oprah and writes best-selling books about authenticity and vulnerability and being daring. She is the very definition of having your shit together. But I know I can call her up at midnight and say, "I'm super scared that I'm fucking everything up." And she'll say, "Same here. There's a lot of that going around. What's wrong with us?" And then we'll talk it out. And in the end, we'll feel better that we both feel shitty because we each respect the other. And if we both feel like failures, then all bets are off. And probably everyone feels like this. Then I tell Brené that her fear of failure is a good thing because no one can write helpful books about honest emotions if they're already perfect. So technically, feeling fucked up is just the first step to her next bestseller. And then she reminds me that my entire livelihood is based on me mortifying myself. So if I suddenly got sane, I'd become unemployed. And she's right. But I'm still afraid that I've written something awful in this book, so I've decided that I will intentionally make a mistake in here on purpose. So just be prepared. And now I can relax, because if I fuck something up, I can just explain that that was my intentional mistake and 10 points to you for finding it. Brené says this is a fine idea, so technically I think that just means I can intentionally fuck shit up as prescribed by a doctor. Wow, that is totally weird. You sound super paranoid. you only think it's weird because you have never accidentally written something offensive. I write intentionally offensive stuff all the time, and I'm prepared to take the heat on that, but I'm always afraid of writing or saying something that I have no clue is awful. Like one time, I wrote that a friend had welched on a bet, and Spellcheck was like, "That's not a word. Did you mean to say Welsh?" And I was like, "Jesus, Spellcheck, that's a bit racist, isn't it?" I write about someone not paying their debt, and you're like, "I bet it was the Welsh. Sort yourself out, Spellcheck." But then I looked it up online and read that the suspected origin of the phrase welch on a bet is an offensive disparagement, quote, on account of the alleged dishonesty of the Welsh. I didn't even know that was a thing. It's like when little kids would say, "My sister got a bigger piece of pie and now I feel gypped." And then I got older and I found out the gyp was a derogatory term for gypsy, and so I nipped that in the bud. But the best replacement the dictionary offered was flimflam, and it just sounds ridiculous to say, "Your dessert is bigger, I feel flimflammed." No one's taken that complaint seriously. So instead, I just end up feeling bitter about pie and say nothing. And also now I'm worried that the word flimflam is somehow offensive to the Flemish. Wow, you have really overthought this. Well, I have an anxiety disorder. This is what it's like in my head all the time. I'm also worried that writing about struggling with my weight is going to piss people off because society is already overly focused on appearance, and I'm not helping by talking about how I feel fat sometimes. And I also worry that I might get skinny accidentally, and then people who see me on tour will be pissed because they won't realize that my weight fluctuates by 60 pounds depending on how sick or tired or depressed I am, and I'll have to carry around unflattering pictures of me as evidence and bring affidavits from my doctor who continually tells me that I need to lose weight until I get incredibly sick or too depressed to eat for a week, and then he's like, "You look great. Why are you in the ER again?" I mean, I'm sensitive about my weight, but overall, I love who I am, and I prefer my curves because when I'm fatter, my wrinkles disappear. No one ever tells you that, but when you're older and you suddenly get skinny, you also suddenly age 5 years because your fat isn't filling out all of your wrinkles anymore. I sometimes get hassled also for using the word fat, but I also use the word crazy to describe myself, and I'm fine with that. Because I'm taking those words back. And I'm also taking sexy back because, frankly, Justin Timberlake has had it too long and he didn't even need it. And I'm taking frustrated because that's not a real word. Stop using it. Long story short, I am often crazy and sometimes overweight. It's not always ideal, but it makes me who I am. Literally. Plus, I won't have to feel bad for eating too many egg rolls because if I suddenly get skinny, that's going to be hard to explain. And that's why I had cheesecake last night, because it's part of my craft. Okay, how about this one? Is there ever a line that you won't cross in writing? I am relatively filterless, but I do have boundaries. When my last book came out, everyone I wrote about got to read it before it went to press, and they were all given full permission to take out anything they wanted. And to their great credit, they were cool with everything. And in fact, they were the first people to say, "Hey, I have pictures of your dad's armadillo racing championship ring and of the pet raccoons wearing shorts that lived in our house. Do you want those?" I do have boundaries. I don't tell stories that I think a mean 14-year-old girl could use against Haley one day. I don't write about anything that I'm currently fighting with someone about or anything where I'm not the biggest butt of the joke. There are a lot of stories that I don't write because they're not mine to tell, but I think telling my stories helps to encourage putting other stories out there. When I first started writing, my father was very quiet about his own struggles. But after seeing the response of people who've read my stories, he's much more open. And that is a wonderful thing. When we share our struggles, we let others know that it's okay to share theirs. And suddenly we realize that the things that we were ashamed of are the same things everyone deals with at one time or another. We are so much less alone than we think. Do you ever worry that you'll pass on your mental illness to Haley? I did used to worry, but she's 10 now, and I can see that she doesn't have the same anxiety issues I had at her age. It's possible she'll struggle with mental illness, and if so, I'll try to understand and probably fail and try again until I get it right. It would almost be easier if she had the same issues that I have because I could help her and teach her the tools that I've learned, but she's born who she was born to be. My sister and I were raised exactly the same way, and we could not be more different. One of her daughters is more like me, and my daughter is more like her. That's baffling for all of us, but it's not our fault. We're born the way we are. One of the best things that you can do as a parent is realize that your child is nothing like you and everything like you. Okay. You get asked to do a lot of speaking and TV. Do you feel famous? I just cleaned up cat vomit. I feel queasy. Okay, let me rephrase. Does it ever feel like everyone wants a piece of you? Like they're pissed off and they want to fight me? What? You mean like, hey, asshole, you want a piece of me? No, not like that at all. Or did you mean they literally want a piece of me? Like they need my kidneys? They just want to dismember me? Because that still seems like people are mad at me. You don't usually want to dismember people you like. I think you've confused famous with despised. No, I meant like a metaphoric piece of you. Oh, right. Sorry. These questions are making me paranoid and then I get defensive. Yeah, I can see that. What the hell does that mean? You want a piece of me? And now I see why you don't do interviews. Honestly, I'm doing it for the good of humanity. Someone should get me a medal. Okay, well, I can't think of any more questions. I can't think of any more answers. We make a good team. Amen, mister. Chapter 19. I'm turning into a zombie one organ at a time. Last year, my friend Laura woke up when her husband was tapping on her head at 2 a.m., but when she tried to wave him off, she realized that he was fast asleep and on the other side of the bed. And that's when she put her hand up to her head and felt something warm and moving. She thought it was her son's guinea pig, so she turned on a light and found a live possum on her pillow that was chewing off part of her hair to make a nest. She screamed, obviously, and the possum hissed angrily and ran into the living room, and she made her husband go after it, even though he was certain that she had just dreamed it. And she was like, really? Am I dreaming all this slobbery hair on my pillow? Then the possum charged, and they had a full-out possum battle in the living room, which did not end well for the possum. But don't feel too bad for it, because of the entire wild kingdom, Texas possums are the dickiest animals ever. My dad made me raise an orphaned possum when I was 10, and every time I fed it, it hissed and glared at me like it wanted me to die in a fire. It was a very imaginative, bitey possum and also a total douche canoe. Eventually, it was old enough to be set free, but a few months later, it came back to our house and died on the porch, probably out of spite. It's hard to tell with possums. Laura's possum hair story always struck me as being one of the worst ways to wake up at 2 a.m. until the day that I woke up at that exact same time and found that my right arm had been ripped off and replaced by bees. Or at least that's what it felt like. And I lay there for a second, thinking that I was certainly dying and that if a possum had chewed off my arm, I would probably bleed out within minutes and that this was exactly the sort of way that I would die. I considered nudging Victor softly so that his last moments with me would be romantic and tender, but then my chest spasmed and I may have involuntarily punched him in the neck as hard as I could. Luckily for him, that wasn't very hard as I was fragile and dying, and so he groggily asked, "Christ, did you just punch me in the neck?" And I screamed, "A possum just ate off my arm!" And actually, that's probably the worst way to wake up ever. I felt certain that I was near death, and Victor switched on the lights and pointed out that there was no blood and that I was probably just having a Charlie horse in my chest, which I'm pretty sure is not a real thing. I gasped for breath, and I told Victor that I was having a heart attack. Then he pointed out that I was clutching the wrong side of my chest for it to be my heart, and that's when I realized that I was probably having a heart attack so bad that my heart was trying to run away, or maybe my right boob was exploding. I tried to explain this to Victor, but he was too busy yelling at me to calm down, and so I explained that I needed to go to the hospital, except what came out was, "I've swallowed a leprechaun, and it's eating its way out of my chest!" This is when Victor assumed that I had had some sort of a stroke, and he got Haley and me into the car as quickly as possible. Haley was still mostly asleep, and so I tried to be quiet so that I wouldn't scare her. Victor kept telling me to breathe, and I told him that I already knew how to breathe, and why do people even say that? Because it's not like people just forget to breathe. He pointed out that perhaps people do, and maybe that's why people die all the time. And then another spasm hit me, and I bit through my lip and passed out. When I came to, there were police lights flashing, and Victor was in the process of getting arrested for speeding. But then he explained that he was speeding because his wife was having a heart attack, and the cops came to my door, looked at me, and called for an ambulance. Then they proceeded to yell at Victor for stupidly driving so fast when he could have just called for an ambulance himself. But in his defense, he wasn't thinking straight and had just been punched in the neck by a woman who claimed to have a leprechaun inside of her. The ambulance arrived, and the EMTs tried to get me to walk to the gurney, but my entire body was shutting down, and I couldn't stand up straight from what I just assumed was spontaneous retroactive scoliosis. The next 20 minutes were a blur, but I remember looking at my feet as the ambulance careened down the road and thinking that I should totally tweet a picture of this. And then I realized I hurt too much to use Twitter, and that's when I knew I was dying. The EMT strapped monitors to my heart and took my vitals and then told the driver to make it quicker. And then he said, "Sweetheart, are you allergic to nitroglycerin? Because I need to give you some." And that seemed really bizarre because I clearly remember that episode of Little House on the Prairie when the wheat crop failed and Pa had to take that job driving the wagon of highly explosive nitroglycerin and he almost blew his balls off. And then the EMT asked again and I said, "I'm allergic to exploding." And he looked at me funny and told the driver to speed up again, probably because he thought I was hallucinating because he didn't watch enough Little House on the Prairie. Regardless, he made me hold nitroglycerin under my tongue, and it tasted a lot like pain, but that sort of made sense because I was letting an explosive melt in my mouth like a poisonous Jolly Rancher. Moments later, I was being whisked into the emergency room while a horde of doctors tried to ascertain what was wrong with me. Patient complained of severe chest pains, blood pressure is elevated, the EMT said. "And I ate explosives," I whispered, but no one was listening because they were too busy pulling my shirt off and doing an EKG, which apparently told the doctor that my heart was perfectly fine and that I probably had gas. I was relieved that I wasn't having a heart attack, but I was pretty sure I was still dying, and so I screamed, "Make it stop or I'll cut you," right as Victor rushed into the room. "She's not good with pain," he explained as the doctor backed away from the gurney. And then the doctor nodded and ordered something diluted to give me. And I told him I wanted full strength. And then he explained that he had actually said dilaudid and that this was some major pain reliever. After a few excruciating minutes later, a nurse injected me with the dilaudid and then the pain abated and I decided not to set fire to the hospital after all. In fact, I felt so grateful that I thought that I should make up for my poor behavior by sharing a bit of trivia. "Did you know," I asked to no one in particular, "that sharks are attracted to urine?" "She'll be high for a little while," the nurse said to Victor. "So no matter how scared you are," I continued, "do not urinate." "And that's how you know the drugs are working," said the nurse. "No," Victor sighed, "it's actually not. This is your tip. She does this at restaurants too." I tried to protest, but I was a bit too nauseous to point out that I only do it when we have excellent service or when the waiter refills my Diet Coke without me having to ask for it. And then I blinked and we were home. I might have been high. And also, I was a little mortified that I had mistaken gas for a heart attack, but I trusted the doctor and was relieved that it would never happen again, until 2 weeks later when it totally happened again. I want to go ahead also and tell you that there is a footnote here for the word dilaudid, because spell check, whenever you write it in, spell check says that the word dilaudid is not a word and that the word that I'm looking for is diluted, and I don't appreciate what you're implying, spell check. So, back to 2 weeks later, I'm dying again, and this time I was certain I was dying, but I was calm enough to let Victor drive me to the hospital at a normal rate of speed because in spite of the fact that I hurt more than when I was in labor, I was pretty sure the doctor was just going to tell me that I needed to fart really bad. We arrived and they recognized me immediately because apparently I have that sort of face, or maybe because most people don't give out valuable shark advice for services rendered. I calmly explained that this was not gas and that it felt like I was having labor pains in my chest and that possibly I had developed an extra vagina and needed to push. No one believed me, and so I screamed, "I hurt and you're supposed to fix me, so give me dilaudid." And then Victor told me to stop talking because I looked like a drug seeker. And I explained that that was very astute of him because I was a drug seeker and I was seeking drugs to make my invisible chest vagina stop being such an asshole. Then he explained that drug seeker is medical code for addicts who come into the hospital looking for a fix and that screaming the actual name of the drug that I wanted was not helping my case. Luckily, there was a doctor there who did a ton of blood work while I was screaming and realized that there was something wrong and that I was probably passing a gallstone. They gave me drugs, and they told me to see a gallbladder specialist to make sure that the stone had passed. I told them that hamsters can only blink one eye at a time, and I considered this a fair trade, but they billed my insurance company anyway. I went to see a group of gallbladder specialists, but they all said that it was better to not do surgery because maybe I wouldn't have another attack. But I always find that removing body parts that want to kill you is a good thing. So they referred me to Dr. Morales, who was known for taking out gallbladders like crazy. Maybe he collects them. It's hard to know. What I did know, though, was that Dr. Morales didn't have a normal office, and instead, he just used the one from the nearby colon and rectal surgery clinic, which was disconcerting for a number of reasons. First, because I was pretty sure I didn't want my gallbladder removed rectally, and second, because the pictures in the waiting room were of asses. Literally. Dr. Morales was over 80, spoke English only when he had to, and had been doing gallbladder removal since before my mom was alive. He was odd but brilliant, and after a look at my chart, he told me that my gallbladder was lingering and was diseased. I explained that it wasn't really lingering so much as it was loitering and that I wanted to have it removed. I wondered if you could file a restraining order against your gallbladder for loitering since it's not wanted and it's also trying to kill you, and then you could call the police and have your gallbladder removed and never have to pay for it because it was creating a public nuisance. Unless you have to pay the police to remove people who are public nuisances. I don't know. Frankly, I have never been on the complaining side of that scenario. Dr. Morales said that he would fill me full of carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide, whichever one is not poisonous, and yank out my gallbladder through a hole in my belly button. But when I asked if I could keep my gallstones so that I could make a necklace out of them, he said that he couldn't do that because the new regulations are assholes. And he said that he couldn't even give people who had been shot the bullets that he dug out of them because they're considered to be, quote, medical waste once they've been pulled out of your body. This seems a bit hypocritical because my daughter came out of my body and they totally let me take her home. And some people even bring home their placenta and make their family eat it. Seriously, that's a thing. And no one ever complains about that, except for the people who have to eat the placenta, probably. Anyway, I explained that I was pretty sure that wearing my gallstones was less offensive than making your family unwittingly eat your placenta, and Dr. Morales agreed with me and said that he had totally had the same argument a dozen times, which seems like an odd argument to have more than once. He did, however, agree to take lots of pictures and share them with me. And my friend Miley offered to come and take pictures of the surgery, and I almost took her up on it because she is an amazing photographer. But then I remembered hearing that after the surgery, the doctor pushes all of the leftover carbon whatever gas out of your belly button. I don't think that I would want anyone to witness me forcibly farting out of my own belly button, because if people are really your friends, this is exactly the sort of shit you should want to protect them from. Like it says in the Bible, being a friend means never having to witness farting belly buttons or something. I might be misremembering. As I waited in the hospital room for the surgery to commence, I was a bit worried because you always hear those horror stories about people getting things left in them or having the wrong body part removed. What if I wake up and have a penis? I asked the nurse. She assured me that that would not happen. She said that this was a normal fear and that often she sees people write, "not this leg," on their good leg when they're in for knee surgery. And I considered doing that, but everywhere. Small notes all over my body saying things like, "no, not there. You're getting warmer. What the shit are you doing? I need that. Don't fuck with that. That's mine." But Victor wouldn't give me a Sharpie because he said I couldn't be trusted when I was fully sober, much less high on pain drugs. So instead, I pulled out my lucky nipple. Side note here. On book tour once, a woman brought me a fake nipple that she makes for people who want bigger nipples or are recovering from a mastectomy. It looks amazingly realistic, and I often wear it peeking out of my shirt to see if people will tell me that I have a nip slip. If they do, I remove the nipple and I thank them for being decent. It is an excellent way to single out the awesome people. Also, if I'm at a bar and the bartender won't look at me, I'll put the nipple on my forehead because it always gets people's attention. I stuck the lucky nipple on my stomach, and when the nurse came back in, I said, "I think I'm having some sort of an allergic reaction. Is this supposed to be there?" And I pointed at the very realistic stomach nipple that wasn't there a few minutes ago when she'd begun prepping me for surgery. To her credit, she was not surprised at all, which makes me think there are way more people than you think growing extra nipples, and also that she's probably not the most observant nurse ever. They eventually wheeled me in, and the surgery was probably very surgical, but I don't remember it because I was high. The recovery was a bit painful because my gallbladder was more infected than expected, but it was somewhat entertaining for people who weren't me. "I need drugs," I moaned to Victor from my hospital bed. He looked at his watch. "Mm-mm, not for another 20 minutes. "Why do you hate me?" "I don't hate you," he said as he looked back down at his magazine. "I just don't want you to overdose on morphine." "Fine," I said. "Distract me then." "Okay, this magazine says that you can tell what you would want to do with your life if you just take away all thoughts of risks. So, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail?" "I'd be a Pegasus." "Yeah, that's not really how this works. I'd be a brown Pegasus, though, because if you were a white Pegasus, you'd be hounded by Lisa Frank fans and 9-year-olds. And black Pegasuses are just as bad because they're all badass and heavy metal bands would want to kidnap them. But no one wants a shabby brown Pegasus. I could just flap around the neighborhood and no one would really care. And maybe I'd wish for back herpes so that people wouldn't hassle me for rides." Victor looked back at his magazine. "Yeah, I'm not going to talk to you if you're not going to take this seriously." "I am taking this seriously," I said. "I would be a rumpled brown Pegasus with back herpes if I knew I couldn't fail." "That's not how this works," Victor said. "It's supposed to teach you what you really want in life." "This is what I want." "Pick something real, Jenny." "Fine," I huffed. I thought for a few seconds. Then I guess I'd choose failing. I choose to fail, but I couldn't fail. So that would create a wormhole or some sort of paradox, and then the whole world would explode. Victor raised an eyebrow. "You're going to blow up the world because you didn't get your way? Don't you think you're overreacting a bit?" "No, I think I need more morphine." "Well, I think this conversation proves you've had enough." I crossed my arms. "I'm going to tell the nurse that you're mean to me and you won't let me have back herpes or drugs." Victor looked back at his magazine. "Yeah, good luck with that." I looked at the on-duty chart in my room and was very confused about the fact that there was a nurse assigned to my room whose name was Labia, L-A-B-Y-A, and I couldn't stop myself from wondering if it was actually pronounced like labia or if it was more of like a short A, like labia. There actually is a real picture of this, and I know you can't see it because you're listening to the audiobook, but this is for real. When the nurse came back to give me a shot in the ass cheek, I figured that all social pretenses were gone, and so I said, "I just have to ask, is it pronounced labia or labia?" And she shook her head in confusion, saying, "I thought you were here because of your gallbladder." And I said, "No, I mean on the menu. Is that labia?" And she asked, "You're asking me if labia is on the menu?" Victor sank into his chair and tried to pretend he wasn't there. I explained that I was not hitting on her and that I was referring to the chart on her desk. And then she stared at it and then at me with a furrowed, confused brow, probably because she was now offended that I wasn't hitting on her. Then she took a deep breath and said, "Latoya." "That says Latoya." And I looked closer and it totally did say Latoya. But in my defense, it looked like labia from a distance. Much like tacos or Georgia O'Keeffe paintings. Then Dr. Morales came back in, and he showed me pictures of my gross removed gallbladder, which was filled with stones, and he said it was really good we did the surgery because my gallbladder was mostly dead and was beginning to affect my other body parts because it had started to gangrene. "Gangrene?" I asked. I didn't even think that was still a thing. It's like I'm on the Oregon Trail all over again. And then Victor pointed out that I was thinking of dysentery, and Dr. Morales was like, you had dysentery on the Oregon Trail? None of this is in your chart. And I said, I am guessing you didn't play a lot of educational computer games when you were a kid. And he said that they didn't have computer games when he was a kid. And I explained that that's probably why he never got dysentery in a video game. Dr. Morales shook his head. That sounds unsanitary. Just where were you putting these games? I explained that that wasn't really what I meant, and I redirected the conversation back to my zombie gallbladder. Victor tried to argue that my gallbladder was not zombified, but I disagree. It was slightly alive, but mostly dead, and was infecting everything it touched. It was literally the living dead. That's kind of the very definition of a zombie. So basically, I was turning into a zombie one organ at a time. And I had a bunch of tubes in me to drain out all the bad stuff, which was shitty because I had to keep them in for a week. And when I went home, the cats thought that those tubes coming out of my stomach were great cat toys and kept batting at them and trying to hang on them. It's funny until your pain pills wear off. I don't recommend it for recovery. Victor said he wasn't surprised that my ordinary gallbladder surgery, one that he'd had as an outpatient, had turned into weeks of hassle because my body is known for being complicated and as weird as I am. But I'm not the only one with weird body parts. For example, Victor insists that he has internal ear flaps, which is just ridiculous. When I go underwater, I always end up with an ear infection, and then Victor blames me because I didn't close my ear flaps. And he's right because they don't exist. He disagrees and claims that my ear flaps are just weak. He says his ear flaps are almost superhuman. As he says, I use them to drown out your crazy so they get a lot of practice. I don't believe in ear flaps, but if I did have them, I probably lost them when I was little because I got so many ear infections that my eardrums burst. My mom would always try to cure them the old-fashioned way by pouring olive oil in my ear and putting a cotton ball into it. The first time that I tried olive oil in a restaurant, I was like, this tastes like ear ointment, and that's because it was ear ointment. And that's the reason why I don't like olives or olive oil, because they taste like ear infections. A week after surgery, my friend Miley drove me to the ASS clinic to have my surgical tubes removed. Dr. Morales was in rare form, and he started talking about catacombs and the mounting national debt, and he closed the small talk by saying, we're doomed, end of days. Thank God I'm dying soon so I won't have to witness it like you will. This is all true and is not an exaggeration at all. He said it very cheerfully, though. The man has a hell of a bedside manner. Finally, Dr. Morales clapped his hands as if to signal that the small talk was over, and he told Miley to pin me to the table. Miley looked at him for a second to see if he was joking, but he explained that I had to be pinned to the table by someone so that I wouldn't punch him when he yanked the tubes out of my stomach. So she shrugged good-naturedly and totally pinned me to the table. This is the sign of a good friend. Or a terrible one. Maybe both. Anyway, then the doctor unstitched me and yanked, and it felt as if I had accidentally gotten a jump rope wrapped around my liver, or like I was one of those dolls that talks when you pull the string in her back. And the thing that I said was, ugh! Which roughly translates to, so now I know what a yo-yo feels like and also why you think your patients want to punch you. As we were driving home, Miley said, you know, this shit could only happen to you. It's like you manifested the exact kind of crazy, fantastic doctor to fit your life. I would never have believed it if I weren't there. And yeah, that's sort of how my whole life has been. Chapter 20. Cats are selfish yawners and they're totally getting away with it. The fourth argument I had with Victor this week. I was just thinking, I said to Victor, that when I see other people yawn, I yawn because it's contagious, but when I see cats yawn, it never makes me yawn. You know, Victor says, you don't actually have to tell me everything that pops into your head. I continued, so then I went on the internet to find out why that is, and apparently we yawn when other people yawn because we see them getting lots of delicious air, and our brain is like, fuck, that looks delicious. Grab some quick before that bitch takes it all. Got it. So you yawn because you're selfish. No, yeah, not just me. Everyone yawns because they're selfish. But I think we don't yawn when we see cats yawn because they have such little mouths that we don't feel threatened about them taking our air. And also, did you ever notice that cats don't make that sucking in, hoovery noise when they yawn? I'm sorry, the what? Oh, you know, the when a normal person yawns, you hear that loud intake of air like a tire going flat, but in reverse. But when cats yawn, they don't make any noises at all. Why is that? You're asking me why cats don't yawn properly? Is it because they aren't actually yawning and they're really just stretching their cheek muscles? Or is it because they've learned how not to make that gaspy, I'm still in all the good air and leaving you with carbon dioxide noise so we won't gulp down all the air after they yawn? Victor shook his head. I don't even know where you're going with this. I'm just saying, are cats not yawning audibly because they want all the air to themselves? Just stop, Victor said. Stop talking. You can just tell me if you don't know, Victor. I don't know either. There's nothing to be ashamed of here. Victor shook his head. I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on that. Winner of the argument? Cats, because they are getting a shit ton of oxygen and no one is challenging them on it.